No Direction and Paizo team up to bring you the Gen Con 2018 seminar coverage. No Direction would like to thank our advertising sponsor, the Roll for Combat Starfinder Actual Play Podcast. Listen at rollforcombat.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Designing Pathfinder Monsters. We are going to go ahead and introduce ourselves, and then we'll start telling you kind of about how we philosophically and mechanically approach creating monsters for the Pathfinder role-playing game. I'm Logan Bonner. I'm a designer on the design team.
I'm Ron Lundeen. I'm a developer, primarily on Adventure Paths.
Hi, I'm Luis Loza. I'm also a developer working mostly on campaign setting and player companion lines.
All right, so we'll probably kind of talk a little bit about designing monsters, and then we'll kind of do a little bit of kind of a workshop of inventing a specific monster and kind of talking about how we'd approach it. So I think let's start with saying kind of our first steps when we're making a monster. For me personally, if I'm making a monster, I like to start kind of knowing the context in which I'm going to be using the monster, which is especially important if it's in an adventure or setting book for a specific location. If you're doing like a bestiary, then you might just kind of come up with something more general purpose. But I like to know the context so that can inform who it's going to be interacting with, the type of environment it lives in, and that sort of thing. How about you, Ron?
I do some monster creation, but the bulk of the work that I've had doing the back matter of Adventure Paths, I've recently moved to the adventure itself, but when I was doing the back matter of the Adventure Paths, a lot of that was developing monsters that come in. And my attitude with that, in addition to sort of concepting the monsters to assign them out to the freelancers, and when I look back at them, I want to make sure it works in sort of a cohesive way with the rest of the adventure in which it sits. So I want to make sure it's got an appropriate challenge rating, it's appropriate thematically, and that there's some measure of variety to the monster. I'll speak more about what it is I'm actually looking for when I see those monsters back, but that's sort of where I come into the monster concepting.
As someone who did a lot of monsters for freelance and continues to do so, including for the likes of Ron, I like to, if I haven't already been given, you know, I'd need a CR8 aberration that does X, Y, and Z, a lot of the times I like to come up with an idea of what the monster might look like or a specific ability that I'd like to have on the monster. So, you know, if I decide it grabs you from far away and swallows you, and then as soon as you get swallowed, it teleports you somewhere else because its stomach is a planar rift to something or another. You know, those are the kind of ideas that usually spark the idea for the greater monster as a whole. So yeah. Then, you know, you decide it needs to be able to do this. It might have reach. It might be large, or you know, things like that, based on those few core concepts that monster might have.
Yeah, I think after kind of knowing just the basic context of a thing, one of the places I like to start with for designing out the full monster is kind of saying, how is encountering this monster different from encountering every other monster? Like, why are you using this one specifically instead of all the other options that are out there? I think that can really help kind of crystallize the idea of it, and then you kind of build around that and see where that leads you. So let's talk a little bit about... Ron, you were saying that you often develop monsters. So why don't you go ahead and say kind of like what you're looking for when you're collecting monsters? So.
Often in the process, if I find a freelancer that is doing a monster, I can use Luis's example because he's right here. I needed two quaddles, one of CR6 and one of CR8 that are different than the other types of quaddles we've done before. Go. I mean, that was the extent of the direction that he got. When I get those, now that I have those in, I'm going to be looking for a couple of things, and this is true for any of the monsters that I get in. I first want to take a look to make sure that the basic statistics of the monster align to that table in the back of the bestiary that many people know is there, but few people look at. It's actually a good solid guide to determine what's the expectations of each CR, what ought the monster's armor class be, how many hit points should it have, what are its saving throws like. A monster that skews heavily away from those in a lot of areas is probably a problematic monster when it actually hits the table. Monsters that otherwise sort of break the rules in a sneaky way aren't helpful. You know, a monster can be a couple points of an armor class higher, that's fine, but a monster that's a couple armor class points higher and has a ton of resistances and immunities and is incorporeal, I mean, that becomes really problematic. So aligning with that bestiary table is important. The other thing that I look for, and this is actually something that newer freelancers have sort of a bigger problem with than some of the veteran freelancers, is I don't want to see a lot of different abilities from a lot of different books. That's really hard for a game master to use at the table if the monster has spells from Ultimate Magic, and it does, the verbal duels from Ultimate Intrigue, and by the way, it's got some rituals connected to it that require occult adventures. My general rule is anything that's going to require... everything that's not from the core rulebook has to requires a superscript, and if I have more than two different kind of superscripts in a monster, that's too many, and I'll start cutting abilities or modifying abilities. And because I'm looking at a series of five monsters at a time, I don't want two of them to be from two books and then another two books and another book for a total of 10 books. We're actually limited on the number of sources we can refer to in a single product. So what I might do is collapse them even further than that, if necessary. I assume you didn't pull from an awful lot of other things with your quaddles. Yeah. I think it's, when I say it tends to be a problem with newer freelancers, because they want to show off that they've got a real mastery of a lot of elements of the system. I mean, there are ways to show that, but making a super complicated monster is not the best way to do so. The monster's going to be alive for only a few rounds. Let's make it easy on the GM for those few rounds it's alive.
I think...
short outline. Go ahead, Luis.
Going off of the complication thing as well. It's... an aspect of a monster can be complicated. That's fine. If you have one specific ability that might be its main focus, that requires a bit of understanding and maybe... you know, two or three different steps to, like, process everything. That's fine, as long as the rest of the monster is
Want to also give it a bunch of feats that it has to choose whether to use or not and turn on and turn off. You want some focus. Or a ton of spell-like abilities that work for a ton of different similar situations, especially. Like, they all kind of... these are all combat useful, but you kind of want to have the monster have something to focus on for the GM to use. I also want to talk about, since Ron was talking a fair amount about kind of what we look for published monsters, I want to get a quick poll. How many of you here are looking to build monsters to get them published by us or another RPG company? Okay, we've got a couple here. And how many are looking more for advice for building monsters for your home game?
Okay. More than that.
Yeah. Yep. So some of those things that, like Ron was talking about with the sources, if you're building a monster for your home game, you know who's going to have to deal with that load, and that's you. So you can use whatever sources you really feel like. If there are things you're going to have to look up at the table, sometimes it's more efficient not to do that anyway. But when you're, one of the things I like to say is when you're building things for a home game, you have a very important resource that we don't have when we're building things for publication, and that is you know your players. And you know the types of encounters that your players enjoy. If you know that one of your players gets really frustrated whenever their character is stunned or running away or whatever, you might build your monsters with your abilities of that type.
Or more.
If you're trying to get that player to leave the group, yeah, you might passive-aggressively build more of those in. What's some other advice that you have for specifically the home game?
One thing that if you're in a pinch or if you just don't want to do a lot of work, either is fine. You might just reskin an existing monster if something has about the CR that you want, about the stats and damage that you're looking for. You know, let's grab this dire ape and reskin it to look more like a dinosaur, and it still has all the same damage and all the things, and you might add an extra ability here too. But it saves you a lot of work with having to come up with an entire new set of stats and figuring out all the abilities and doing all that math. When it's already there, if you just say it looks different and describe it differently and it attacks differently, it does the same job. It still deals all the damage. It still, you know, uses all the spells that you need, things like that. It makes it pretty easy to just swap something over from another book.
And looking at similar monsters is also a great first step, because you can, sometimes you'll see, like, I can just reskin this, and other times you'll see, oh, here's this thing where a lot of, where this monster and my imagined monster are going to be really similar, but they're different in this way, and it'll kind of crystallize some of those ideas for you. And if you're working on something for publication, looking at existing monsters will tell you the niches we have already filled, so you don't kind of accidentally replicate something that's already out there. So the next thing I'd like to talk about is kind of evocative monsters and having something that is not going to be just kind of on your side of the screen, where you're really demonstrating what the monster is all about to the players in a really engaging way. One of the things I like to bring up when we're talking about this is mechanics that the monster can activate that the players never see. A lot of times that's things like this monster can spend a swift action to give itself a +4 bonus. The players are probably not going to even notice, because if you roll your attack roll and it's getting a +4 bonus from this special ability, the likelihood that that, you know, 20% is going to make a difference, it's substantial, but it's also a pretty good chance, like, I rolled a 19, it would have mattered either way. So I like to do things that are more obvious. So, like, the monster spends an action to light its sword on fire. The players are going to see, oh no, its sword's on fire, that's probably bad for us. In addition, if you're designing a monster and you can find a nice visual representation of it, even if it's just Google something similar and print it out for your players to see, that can be really great just to have kind of a link between what they're hearing from you and what they're seeing. How about the two of you? What are your favorite ways to make monsters evocative?
One of the things I like about making monsters evocative are giving it abilities that it cannot use on its own when the combat starts, but that it either can use or must use once combat has gone on. It's particularly useful to have an ability like a badger rage, right? Once it takes damage, right, then, oh, it's mad. So its attacks become much more effective, and the players know that they're the reason it's done so. And that gives them some sort of ownership or agency about the ferocity of the monster. Or a situation where pieces of a monster fall away, you know, a construct where once it takes a certain threshold of damage, parts of it fall away, maybe it loses an attack, the players feel
state
like we're,
changes.
We're getting somewhere. Yeah. This is happening because of what we've done. Not with to any old you know, any other cause except that it is in conflict with us. That gives players a connection to that monster. Mm-hmm. And they can be represented both visually, that's important, to have an actual loss of an attack, describe how the construct's arms falls off. As well as mechanically.
And we did some of that for the Pathfinder playtest, the animated objects. You can break them, and they've got some hardness, and you smash through that, and it breaks their armor, and they're easier to hit, and that sort of thing. That can be pretty evocative.
Another thing I like to do is use your words, use your descriptions to kind of hint at what a monster might be capable of doing. So if you describe a big monster that looks like it's covered in enormous spines and also its arms are long and noodly and looks like they can pull you in from anywhere, you might know that if you get grabbed, you're going to get impaled on one of these things.
Yeah.
And kind of drives the abilities home. But also you could use it to suggest like weaknesses or resistances and things like that, just giving the players that little extra edge without having to need to roll a knowledge check to understand this. You know, just that the visual or the description can help them feel like, oh, I know what it's going to do. I know what I can try to do to, you know, deal with that or fight against what this monster does. You know, just helping them feel even more awesome with that. I mean, your monsters are there to be scary or antagonists or things like that. But they're also there to, in most situations, I mean, there's times when you're looking to just wipe everything. We'll start over. Most situations is there to make your players feel heroic at the end of it, even if they're, you know, just getting through by the skin of their teeth. As long as if they get through it and they feel excited about that, that's always a great feeling.
Mm-hmm. I want to touch really briefly. I'm guessing, are most of you here to learn how to design monsters for Pathfinder 1 rather than the playtest? Yeah. I'm going to just touch really briefly, but we're mostly going to be talking about kind of Pathfinder 1 design. Pathfinder 2, monsters are going to be built a little bit differently. You're not going to kind of do hit dice and feats and kind of calculate monsters the same way you do with the PC. It's a little more benchmark-based, so kind of like that table 1-1 from the bestiary. It's going to be kind of more built around using those numbers and then picking abilities and deviances from the baseline in order to make your monster for Pathfinder 2. But like I said, we're not going to go super deep into that. If anybody has questions about that, you can catch me later after this panel or back at the booth. So the last thing I want to talk about before we start taking some questions and kind of doing a really quick kind of monster workshop is pitfalls of monster design. Like, what are the things you see, especially Ron, with doing a bunch of development on monsters, what are some of the things you see come up again and again that people think they've created a monster correctly, but there's a big problem with the way they've designed it?
One of the things that I see I hinted at it earlier, where something seems to fall within the right numbers, but in practice it does not. An armor class, it's okay to be a little high, but it's got a bunch of resistances. Happens with attacks. A lot of times a creature will have very strong attacks for its CR, which is fine, and then be given power attack or something that actually would ramp it up even higher. It's problematic. It is not by accident or by laziness that the monsters that we have an awful lot of dull feats in them, improved initiative and lightning reflexes and things like that. That's take some of the load off of what do these specific feats do to balance out the numbers and kind of get the focus on the more interesting abilities that the creature has.
One thing I try to avoid, mostly because it makes my life as a writer easier, but it's also the thing I suggest for a lot of people, is you don't have to... If you come up with an ability, make sure it doesn't already exist. It's a lot easier to just grab an existing universal monster ability from the back in the appendix, or copy and paste an ability from a different monster, than just write it up all again. Or even if you do write an ability, if there's something that's similar to that, or you can use some other language, borrow that language. It'll make things easier in the long run. It's pretty easy to get long-winded and complicated about how an ability works when you can just say, "Oh, it does the exact same thing as a Tyrannosaurus's, the terrifying bite where it does double damage with strength or something like that." Yeah. It's pretty easy to get focused on. Okay, how do I make this ability and figure it all out when it kind of already exists and you can just grab that from somewhere else.
I want to jump on that real quick to say it's particularly the case when you're talking about families of monsters. If you've got a new psychopomp that's going to shepherd the spirits of the dead, you want it to be able to see ghosts and stuff like that. Well, psychopomps have that ability, and a psychopomp that doesn't already have it would be kind of weird. It's sort of an assumption to make your game internally consistent that they all have the spirit sensibility that already exists.
I'd also say when you're designing a monster, kind of look at how long that monster is going to be significant in your campaign and put in the appropriate amount of work. Because if you're prepping for your game and you're saying, I'm making this new race and they're going to adventure through this dungeon that has many, many, many of these, then you might put in the full effort to do it upright and do it a complete version. If you've got this is a squid slug that's going to be in one fight and that's it, you might kind of do a skeleton of it and not figure out all its skill bonuses and that kind of thing. And then use table 1-1 to kind of fill in the gaps if they come up during the game.
Another thing I like to try to avoid is, make sure to keep in mind, is knowing when abilities tend to start appearing in terms of the game's progression. So certain abilities like spell resistance on monsters don't start appearing until higher levels like 7 or 8th level.
And stuff like flight, even.
Yeah, flight. If you give a flying enemy at level 2, most, if you have a party that has no ranged weapons and no other way to handle that they're just kind of stuck there and can't really do anything about it. And this even happens with some of the monsters you might decide to use. A CR is only there to get you started. You have to make sure you understand the monster and what it's capable of. For example, the white gives energy drain, which can give you a negative level, and it says it's CR3. Technically, that works fine for level 1 players, but as soon as you take one negative level at first level, they're dead. That maybe you should hold off on giving abilities like that, and understand based on what else exists in the bestiary to decide. Oh, maybe I'll hold off on spell resistance, and this is an 8th level spell. Maybe it shouldn't be a spell like ability at that 3rd level. Things like that.
We flip that a little bit. Well, on the other side as well, if you have some very powerful monster, be aware if there's some sort of easy tactic that is going to defeat it. There's been an awful lot. There have been several different iterations of the Tarrasque, and a lot of the "ho-ho, I can beat the Tarrasque" comes down to the thing can't fly. I just fly above it and shoot it till it's dead, and then wish it dead, or whatever the mechanics are. So if you've got some super powerful monster that can't get at flying creatures and you expect it to challenge 14th level PCs, well, 14th level PCs are just going to fly out of the way, right? So there's some, you want to make sure that it is, when you say appropriately balanced for the CR compared to the players, that works for the monsters against the players as well.
Yeah, and one other pitfall I'll mention right quick before we move on to kind of the workshop is don't make a monster good at everything. Kind of think about your monster as like, okay, what is the thing I want it to be really good at? And then don't make it great at saves and great at attacks and has amazing spell-like abilities and has super good skills and has incredible defenses. Kind of, you want it to have some kind of weak point so that party tactics are going to make a difference in that fight rather than kind of just saying, yeah, it's just really strong across the board. All right, so let's start talking about like how we would approach making a monster. Is there somebody who has like a need in your campaign right now for a specific type of monster?
We've been not, really we, good at we giving can, out monsters.
Though, yeah, so. We can invent a need. So let's say you're doing an adventure that is set on the tundra. Okay. And you look at the options available to you in the game, and you say, you know, I want there to be effectively kind of an oasis kind of thing in the tundra, and there's a monster that lives there. So there's going to be this little area. It's like a hot spring in the middle of this frozen waste, and I want a monster that is going to lurk there and attack you if you try to make camp in this kind of hospitable area. So what are some parameters we might have for this monster? One of the places we often start with for Pathfinder 1 monster design is like kind of the monster type, because that's going to tell us a lot about kind of its strengths and weaknesses. Does anybody have a suggestion?
Elemental.
Right, an elemental. All right. So maybe there's this elemental here, and it could even be that like this elemental's presence is what created this hospitable
oasis.
Area. Yeah. So say we're making an elemental. What are some things that are important to know when making an elemental?
Elementals can't be crit, so you got to be careful with that.
Yeah. They can't be crit.
Can't be
flanked. Yeah.
If you've got a party that has three rogues, you want to have some stuff in mind that this rogue can do. And especially when you're doing home game monsters, you want to be thinking about not just the monster, but its environment and the context it's created. So you might say, I have a bunch of rogue players, so the monster design is important, but I also want to have some environmental stuff that maybe the rogue can do that will help the rest of the party when the rogue's damage output is dropping because they're fighting an elemental specifically.
Here's an important question. What level are our PCs? What level, I mean, how difficult are we trying to make this? Somebody give me a level. What level are your PCs?
10.
Alrighty.
All right.
Well, we could, at that point, we think either there's going to be kind of a little mob of these creatures, and maybe their CR is right around, you know, 8 or 9, or maybe there's
one. And we know they're 10. The first thing we know about the PCs have the ability to fly.
Yep.
There are several other spells that they're going to have access to that make them more powerful, but flight is a really good one. It's a really good benchmark to know that PCs are capable of. So we want a monster that's going to be able to deal with that in some way.
A single devastating attack is better at this CR because the PCs, if one of them gets unlucky with a crit, they can bring a member back from the dead.
Yeah.
They have that capability now, so maybe a single devastating attack is not a terrible idea.
Yeah. And again, if this is for your home game, you know whether they have the diamond dust to do that now or if they're going to have to leave the tundra and...
Which could be a problem. Yeah.
Yep. Go take care of that elsewhere. All right, so we've got a level 10 party, so we know we're going to need a monster that can take on a flying characters and that is going to be pretty resistant to rogues. So what are some ways, what are some abilities that kind of come to mind to kind of build this monster around?
Hallucinatory terrain is probably how that oasis comes about. Maybe
okay.
Elemental is actually just intentionally trapping people.
Yeah. It could be
like that.
Yeah, it can create hallucinatory terrain. So, which kind of leads into, all right, so it can create this illusion, which probably means it has some other illusory or mental powers. What does an elemental with illusory powers kind of look like? What does that kind of say about its nature? Is a good place to start.
I would say illusions and reflections to me say water or ice. So even though this could be an element of it in several different kinds, if it's creating sort of shifting light or illusions to make something hallucinatory, probably has some element of water or ice in it to me.
Okay, yeah. And it could be something like it's a water elemental that is, you know, frozen here effectively, or that can shift change between ice and water. And this illusion is kind of its ideal state, is like this hot spring. but it's kind of trapped here, so maybe it's angry. And so then you might say, it's angry, so it's going to have some anger-based abilities, right? It's going to have things, and like you said, that kind of that change you want in the middle of the combat. Maybe it's just kind of this seething monster, and then when you encounter it, if it gets more angry, it might start creating kind of more environmental effects around it. Or you have the opportunity to sate its rage. Like, consider different approaches to your encounters. If somebody comes up, they realize this is an illusion, they do great on their knowledge check and recognize this elemental, they might say, okay, we're going to try to calm it. So you might say, you might go into this kind of knowing, like, here are the ways it might react if my group approaches this in a different direction. And, you know your group. So if you know they're just going to fight it, maybe you can just say, nah, I don't need to worry about that. And that's kind of part of your time management as a GM is knowing what to concentrate on and those kind of things. All right, any other thoughts from... Yeah.
I actually had an idea for a creature, but kind of wondering how you'd handle it. Mm-hmm. Something along the lines of like a living forge or a living furnace. It kind of starts out more as a construct, but as it's more damaged, more of its like elemental power is exposed. It becomes more elemental. A fire elemental that's actually powering the construct. So it starts out very slow. Maybe hard to actually damage the hardness or AC or something, but as it takes more damage, it maybe deals fire damage to things that are actually close to it, but it's easier to hit.
So I had a question about how to design kind of a living forge construct that has kind of an elemental fire aspect to it, but kind of the shell of a construct or forge that kind of becomes more elemental as you fight it, essentially. So, like, what are some tools for designing that kind of monster?
Well, one thing I like to remember here and there, it's not very common, but you can always mix and match aspects of different creature types. So we could say that this is overall it's an elemental outsider, and give it some of the construct traits, and, you know, maybe later it loses them as it's chipped away its armor and it's less of a construct, but that way it has a bit of both and might even throw players off if that's the kind of thing you're looking for, or reward players that know both about elementals and constructs. Usually abilities like, you know, chipping away at things like that, that is great for, you know, hey, this is my player that sunders a lot of things, or the barbarian that has the adamantine axe. It's great ways to reward things like that. Yeah. And it can be a bit complicated, but if you're willing to go through with that process, just say, you know, once it loses X amount of hit points, its AC drops by this much, and then again this much, or it loses such amount of hardness. Things like that.
This is also like when you're doing a monster like that, it's really great to just compare side by side. Like, here's a fire elemental, and here is a similar construct to what you're looking at. You just kind of say, what is the elemental better at? What is the construct better at? So then when you have your state change, you don't necessarily have just it loses its armor, which is really important and really evocative, but you might also say, now it's not encumbered by this kind of shell now, and now it's faster and can move around more easily. So you want to look at especially if it's a monster you expect to last a while, then you want to have like something else dramatic happening when its status has changed. I really recommend playing like video game boss fights and that kind of thing. they'll tell you a lot about kind of especially longer lasting monsters and how kind of changes in their behavior and their environment can affect the feel of the battle.
So if we go along that line, my thinking is, if I can sort of trace through what I might be doing, I might go, all right, well, so an outsider that's got some construct-type traits to it that gets weaker, is there anything like that I can kind of steal the language from or the ideas from? Oh, inevitables are just like that. Okay. And they've got this constructed ability, which when I look at it, I'm like, well, hey, this constructed ability gives them a bunch of bonus hit points. Maybe in our monster, they have that constructed ability until they lose those bonus hit points, and then it flips sort of the trigger state.
Yeah,
that's why. In that way, that there's a mechanic that already exists in the game that does some heavy lifting in our design here.
Yeah, we had a question over here.
No.
Oh, okay. I designed a monster with a kind of similar theme to this for one of my Pathfinder 2 adventures that I ran at PaizoCon and PaizoCon UK, and it was I was using the museum flip mat, which has this giant stuffed dinosaur in it. So of course I'm going to use a giant stuffed dinosaur.
Of course. But
it's also had an elemental theme. So there was a fire elemental trapped inside this shell, and it has a similar mechanic to that, where you beat through enough of its shell, you could kind of see the tears forming and kind of spewing fire out, until eventually you knocked off the entire frame and you just had this fire elemental raging around. And that's another thing I think can really help with that kind of monster, is really telegraphing those changes. So your players, you're kind of telling your players the changes that they're seeing as they're fighting it, so that when it happens, it's like, oh yeah, see, that was leading somewhere. That's a really great way to keep them engaged in that fight. And it kind of gives them a little bit of anticipation. It's like, when this happens, we can tell something's going to happen. We're not entirely sure what it is. We hope it's good. Or it might explode in a giant fireball. We don't know. Let's hope for the best.
Sure.
Sorry.
No, that's fine.
Similar note to that. As the creature kind of starts out like that, you're talking about the benchmark of, let's say, flying. Maybe it's not in a very small area, per se, but they think, oh, maybe this is an easy fight. It can't reach me. I know Construct. This Construct doesn't have it. Then all of a sudden, it heats up fire breathing.
Sure.
It actually reaches flying.
So the comment we had here was, if you had this type of monster and they were going up against a flying party, the party might think, you know, we're safe, but the monster might be able to, like, breathe fire at them or do something like that. Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
The question more is, would something like that be maybe a little underhanded towards the player? It's like, we weren't expecting this.
The question is whether that is kind of underhanded. I think in this particular example, it is a fire thing that is shooting fire. That makes perfect sense. If it's something where you can look at this monster and logically assume that it might be able to do something like this, I think it's fine. Like, say for example, it's a forge. It spits out a flaming hot piece of metal at you because it's a forge. It is used to forge things, or it's got flaming coals, something like that. Those are all very like, yeah, I could see that, of course. You explained that it looked like a forge full of burning coals. It can shoot coals, sure. Where I think it can really feel more underhanded is when it's just like, it's that monster, but it's just got some random spell-like ability that lets it, you know, fire. Let's go with the most absurd example. It fires like polar ray or something. It's just like, if the player's just like, I don't get it. Why is this happening? Why did it power word stun me? What's happening here? That's when you're really just kind of like making kind of a recipe for frustration with your players.
It just seems that if you want to build something like that, it almost would be an indicator, more or less, as to what's underneath it. So you're almost trying to give your player a hint as to something else is happening here, and it needs to have sort of a visual aspect.
Yeah, the comment there was about kind of giving hints with your description and with the kind of appearance of the monster as to what it's capable of. I think that's also a good one with, like, if you see a very heavily armored monster, that's a pretty good hint that it should have a possibly higher than normal AC. If you see a monster that is not wearing much armor, maybe it's faster. That monster might have as good of an AC, but it's more of a dex kind of theme. And you should probably guess that if you're firing touch spells at it, they're not very likely to hit, because that's the theme of the monster. And a lot of that is kind of in how you describe it as a GM, to kind of give a decent hint of what is going to be best against this monster.
I think it's pretty important to avoid the gotcha situation. Mm-hmm. As a GM. You can maybe get away with it once if it's a kind of a small gotcha. Let's say, you know, your players go against a white dragon and are expecting, okay, I'm going to throw some fire spells at it, and it turns out it's actually a red dragon, that its skin is white for whatever. It's an albino red dragon.
Yeah.
As long as it's not such a big thing that it's going to completely ruin an encounter for a player or for a group. Let's say everyone prepared nothing but fire spells and yeah, things like that. But if it's like a small thing, it's a nice, fun, unexpected twist, but won't completely catch a player off guard to the point where they can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
I think you can do that every once in a while, but it's not something you should hey, every other fight is that gotcha fight, and now you got to know what this gimmick is and that gimmick is. But yeah, doing it once, maybe like in a campaign or twice in a campaign, it's kind of a fun, exciting thing and keeps players on their toes.
A lot of it's about the magnitude, too. Yeah. Like, if somebody gets tricked and, you know, it's not going to kill them, that's a lot easier than if it's going to be something really dangerous. So, like, I like the mimic, for example. It's like, you touch the mimic, you get stuck to it, and now you're fighting this thing you're stuck to. But you're getting to fight it. If it were, you touch the mimic, it wasn't actually a treasure chest, and you instantly die from this poison, that's a very different scenario. Mm-hmm. So as long as it leads to something more interesting, as long as you're kind of escalating things by whatever this trick is, you're going to get more of an interesting rather than frustrating experience.
It also depends a lot on the type of monster, because if a Rakshasa is not being tricky, then you're not really playing to the
right
monster. If some trick doesn't occur in the middle of that combat, then you're not playing the monster to its type. Yeah. In our case, we've talked about this creature that is disguised as some sort of oasis in the middle of the tundra. Mm-hmm. PCs that have met it or have heard about it know there's something kind of tricky about it there. The fact that this tricky disguised ice monster then shoots a bolt of fire as its icy exterior is chipped away seems to be an appropriate. See, it doesn't seem to be super tricky in any way. That seems to be an appropriate move for this type of clever monster or cleverly concealed monster.
Yeah. And you could also do, like, going back to kind of that idea of the hot spring, the like illusion of a hot spring. Think about, like, all right, what is going to happen when people actually go to engage in this? Like, if the fighter strips down and jumps in this hot spring, it's like, woo, a hot spring. Then you kind of need to know, like, what is my fighter's AC like without their +3 armor? If it's not great, then you've got a very different kind of situation for this fight than most of your fights. And you kind of... You are going to be able to kind of develop a best guess as to how your players might approach this. If they tend to be pretty suspicious, then you know it's like, all right, I'm going to detect magic. All right, I'm going to look around. We're going to circle this whole thing for like the next 2 hours and make sure that everything's on the up and up. You can have a pretty good sense that they're going to get through this. They're going to see through this illusion and disbelieve it, and kind of go to more of a straight up fight. So we have this monster that's doing these illusions. It has you kind of trapped out on the tundra. That tells you a fair number of things about kind of the context of this fight. What are some specific abilities we might give this monster, or specific, like, feats and that sort of thing?
Mirror image.
So, once you've kind of revealed this monster, it kind of... Is likely to cast mirror image to defend itself. So when you have something like mirror image, that is going to tell you a fair amount about its defenses, because if it's using mirror image, you probably don't want it to also have an amazing AC and also have a lot of hit points. It might be more of a glass cannon type monster because it has this special defensive ability on it. And that's another thing, is like, try not to double up on too many defenses or offenses of the same type. Like Ron said, with a high amount of damage and power attack, you also don't want to do that on the defensive side, because then you'll just be like, yes, this fight is still going. It doesn't have amazing attacks, but you can just keep wailing on it forever and
like
nothing really happens.
Yeah.
You want to avoid your fights getting too grindy. That can really happen with those kinds of defenses.
So we talked about this creature having a switching point. It's some fiery forge type thing, but it's entombed in some sort of ice. While it's got this sort of crust of ice, is when it's got this hallucinatory terrain mirror image powers. I can see it being a good reward for the PCs. So PCs feel rewarded when a monster has mirror image, when they knock the last of those stupid mirror images down. They like that. One thing that that PCs could also like with this monster, in a different way that would make this memorable, is once you hit enough of damage to it to knock the ice shell away, if it has any mirror images, the rest of them just go away. So being able to describe to that player that happens to hit, your hit strikes the true creature, breaks enough of the ice away that all of the rest of the images fall away. I mean, that player's going to think, yeah, I mean, not only I hit it awesome, and now everybody can pile in.
Yeah, you might look at it that way. You might also look at it and kind of say, okay, I kind of like the mirror image idea. I kind of like the ice shell idea, but I don't want it to be too defensey. So I'm sometimes you just have to kind of narrow down your options and just pick one. Mm-hmm. So you might say, like, I really want to emphasize the illusion aspect of this creature because my group hasn't fought a lot of illusion creatures, and I kind of want this to feel different than some of the other ones. So you might say, all right, I'm going to go away from the ice shell idea and go more into the illusion idea. Or you might, you know, do it the other way around and say, okay, instead of being an illusion at all, this is an actual place that is formed through some other magical phenomenon, and this is the guardian of that place. Like, depending on, you know, how you want to, which of those paths is kind of more appealing to your group, usually. That's a great tiebreaker, is I like both these options, but I think my group would have more fun with this one, is a really good way to go when you're kind of trying to winnow down your choices for your monsters.
I can think of an ability we don't want this creature to have. Even if it's got this forge in the middle of it, what I don't want is an ability where if you hit it with weapons, it has a chance of melting your weapon when you break through. If you already have a creature in that environment at about that challenge rating the Remmer has, which does just that.
Yeah.
It's a little bit duplicative of something else that they might legitimately find. So we want to steer away from that type of ability.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that's part of the design as well, is what might be too... What might seem too similar to other creatures that they can, or if it's in your home game, you know that they will then be going up against.
You can also, with this particular monster, you've got kind of this frozen environment, you've got this hot monster, so you might look at the Remmer has and see, like, what are the ways that this monster deals with it, and you don't want it to, you know, do the melting weapons thing, because that's very kind of an iconic Remmer has thing, but you might look and see, like, are there more minor parts of this monster that might make sense for mine. Like, stealing from other monsters is always a great way to kind of compile your own monster. Your players may or may not notice that you've stolen it, but usually, unless it's like the core thing that monster does, they're probably not going to notice. You can also play with stuff like steam. You know, think about your situation. You've got intense fire, you've got ice. What's going to happen here? There could be steam. They could, you know, melt the ground underneath you and turn the permafrost into mud. You know, if you're flying, that might not matter. So you kind of have to look at, like, how useful is this ability against the specific PCs that it's going to be facing. Like, if you know they're likely to fly around and fight it, then an ability like that might not be super useful.
Yeah, over here.
Yeah, you can kind of use some of the... So the comment here was, you know, what if you get hit with a blast of steam and now you're coated in water and you end up out in the cold? You know, how might that affect you, right? So then you can do stuff like, you know, you start taking cold damage each turn, or you start getting encased in ice and start freezing, you know. Another good place to look for monsters is, if you don't know of a monster that does a specific thing, is looking at spells that have a similar theme, like spells that encase people in ice or, you know, do things like that. You might be able to kind of steal from those and kind of say, okay, the effect is basically like this spell. That can be super useful. Do we have any more questions or ideas for this?
Kind of relates to, what would you kind of put as a stopping point for complexity of the monsters? Obviously, it has a lot more abilities, a lot more conditions, and makes it very cool thematically, but as far as actually running the mechanics of it, sometimes it can be a bit slow and down. Obviously, you don't want multiple creatures running at the same time that have, where you have to track, oh, this one's partial elemental, this one's full construct still, and things like that, but kind of, what would you put as a stopping point?
So the question is, what would you put as the stopping point for the level of complexity for a monster? And you also had a very good point about the quantity of the monster is going to affect that a lot. So if, for instance, with this monster, we're kind of approaching from the idea of, with most of the design we've talked about here, is probably a single monster fighting you. If you're fighting a horde of these, you probably want them to be individually simpler, even though the environment might interact with them in some way. So that is a really important thing, is the complexity value is going to be lower if you're expected to do multiples. My rule of thumb is usually, like, what could I expect this monster to do in three rounds? If it has more stuff than that, and I'm having to make decisions of, like, what do I do with these three rounds, and it has eight different options, then I think the monster is probably over-designed. Do you have some thoughts on where to draw the line on complexity?
I think that it is easier to strip specific abilities away. Now, talking specifically in your home game, if we've got this one Hot Springs Forge monster that the players are coming up against when they're 10th level, but I know as GM they're going to be coming back this way again when they're 14th, 15th level, and maybe there's a whole series of them that make a larger Hot Springs together or something like that. If they've seen the monster before, you can shorthand a lot of the things that would otherwise happen when they encounter a bunch of them at once. In this case, if they've got, for example, some sort of, the hallucinatory train or, mirror image type ability that they have, it either comes on for all of them and goes away for all of them at the same time. That's going to be able to make the encounter easier when there's more of them. It becomes a slightly different monster for the monster design. If you're going to put them into a bestiary, they'd be two different types of creatures, maybe a minion type of creature and the regular one. But the idea is, if you simplify the abilities that the monsters have in order to make a bunch of them easier to fight at higher level, that's a lot easier than doing the reverse, trying to come up with a monster that otherwise sort of falls pretty quickly to higher level adventures and then add a bunch of stuff to it if the PCs are going to fight it sooner than that.
Yeah, and you also kind of mentioned something that when we were talking about trick monsters before, if you have fought a hot spring monster, when you came upon a hot spring, the PCs are going to eye every single hot spring for the rest of the adventure very suspiciously. So be careful what you have be a trick. If the very first NPC they meet who offers them a quest from a certain organization tries to kill them, guess who's not dealing with that organization again?
Yeah.
So kind of be mindful of, like, what you want to do and your general ideas for the future when you do tricky things in your campaigns. So I think we're just about out of time. If anyone has, like, one final question, we can handle that. If not,
sure.
Yeah, over here.
When is it appropriate to give monsters player class levels?
Question is, when is it appropriate to give monsters player class levels? I think you two do a fair amount more of this than I do, so I'll hand that over to you.
It depends. If it's a lot of really small, quick, easy minions, like here is a bunch of doppelgangers with rogue levels, that might be a simple thing. It depends on how complex you want to get, but usually we reserve those for really unique monsters. The common monster is the one that you see in the bestiary. Giving even a single level in fighter means it's exceptionally different from anything else. So, like a thieves guild that's actually all doppelgangers, that might make sense. Or if it's the final boss is this vampire and it has, all these wizard levels. That's usually what you reserve for things more when it's more of a narrative. It's got more of a narrative focus of why does this specific monster have all these class levels and things like that. So I tend to go towards more of the, on the rare occasion, to make it just even more memorable, because if every other thing has six levels of rogue, then it's like, I'm tired of all these sneak attacks, or I'm tired of all these raging, whatever you end up throwing barbarian levels on. So tend to keep it just pretty rare for that.
Yeah, and use it when you have a purpose for it, a specific purpose. Don't just use it to make a monster tougher. Like, if I want my monster to be a little tougher, rather than giving it fighter levels, I would probably, first I would look at simple templates, if it just needs to go up like one CR or something. Or if I needed to go further, then like adding hit dice, rather than like something like making it a fighter.
Yeah, my answer to the question is, when is it appropriate to give a monster class levels if it has a name, right? Because there's not, one of these, rhyme forges we're talking about that is just sort of lurking around in the hot springs, PC stumble across isn't a big deal. But one that's got wizard levels, all the local tribes are going to be talking about this, creature that lurks and, places of safety that has been sort of there. Their ancestors warned them away from, and everyone knows that the they would give the name to the monster, then it has some identity, and if it's got an identity, it's easier to have the...
And it also, giving something class levels is going to make a bigger splash if the players have encountered this type of monster before. And I specifically say players. Like, if you're in your previous campaign, they fought some harpies. And then in your new campaign, they fight a harpy with a bunch of witch levels or something. Then they're going to have context for it. Otherwise, like, if you just want a powerful witch, it doesn't really matter that much whether it's a harpy if they don't really know what a harpy is. And... one quick.
When you say give it a name, like actual shoplifter Winona Ryder, like a rogue that is both charming and disarming, can take away the player's weapons and use them against them. Would that be what you mean by give it a name?
No.
The question is that what quantifies giving it a name? It'd be something like Argonax. The Elder Ice Being might be the name of that,
a proper name.
If the player characters are going to learn its name and are going to shout, Argonax, darn you.
You're saving the tribes from your tyranny.
Yeah. Then it's maybe worth giving it class levels. If they're going to be like, oh, yeah, there was an orc in that room.
And his name was John Smith the Orc. Yeah. That wouldn't be what you want.
We'll put that on its tombstone because we killed it.
I think that's all we have time for then.
All right. So thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
And enjoy the rest of your Gen Con.